It is Saturday, April 6th, and over the next 2 months, 70 acres of parks in Vancouver will be sprayed with the herbicide acylipirin to protect against Japanese beetles. This is the Cambi Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan. And today we're joined by Kelvin Gawley from the Burnaby Now.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back.
Cheers.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking a lot about Burnaby. I had a chance to sit down with the new mayor of Burnaby, Mike Hurley, earlier this week, on Tuesday, I believe, and ask him some questions. So we'll throw it over to that interview in a little bit. Patrons may have already gotten a chance to listen to that, which is a good reminder.
Patreon.com/CambiReport. Patreon.com/CambiReport is the place where you can go to subscribe and support this show. We have a myriad of benefits, including access to our Slack channel and merch and prizes of some kind. I don't know. Do we still have stickers?
We still have stickers.
Yeah.
I should do another send out.
Yeah. I'm throwing up prizes left and right here. Benefits for our Patreons at patreon.com/CambiReport. Please go subscribe, support the show. It makes everything possible. And you'll also be the first to hear about many of the exciting changes coming to the show over the next couple of months.
I think that's a good tease. Let's throw it over to my interview with Mike Hurley now, and then we'll start talking about Burnaby. Burnaby Mayor Mike Hurley, welcome to the Cambi Report. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for taking the time to come and see me.
In October, you unseated longtime Mayor Derek Corrigan, largely on what was seen as discontent over dem evictions, increasing housing unaffordability. Your first action was to halt dem evictions and create this task force, but there's maybe a feeling out there that, is that enough? Have we done enough in Burnaby quickly?
Well, we certainly haven't done enough yet, that's for sure. Although, you know, all these things take a little bit longer than all of us would like to see. I wish I could click my fingers and have some, you know, more affordable rentals within our city. Right now, unfortunately, we have gone a long time with little action being taken on that side, and it's going to take a while to turn that around. But I'm started down this path, and I know that we'll get there over time. The key right now is to try and find some solutions for people as quickly as we can, and that's what I'm working very hard on. And certainly my goal is to, you know, do what I said during the election, and that is to find, you know, more affordable housing and to make rentals and affordable rentals a priority within the city. But I'm not given any illusions that can be done overnight. It's a very difficult task to turn this around, but we will get there.
Well, Burnaby does have a number of tools in its toolbox. It's a very lucky and fortunate city in some ways, in that it has $1 billion in a reserve fund. It has one of the first municipalities in BC to adopt the rental-only zoning bylaw that the province allowed for. Are we still waiting for the results of this task force before some of those start to get put into place, or is there stuff happening now beyond the task force itself?
Well, I'll deal with the rental zoning first. First of all, the rental zoning is going to be a good tool in the toolbox, but let's not kid ourselves that alone is going to be a panacea for what has been happening. You know, our staff is putting together some ideas around the rental zoning right now. So as soon as we're satisfied with that, that will go ahead and won't wait for the task force, because that's something that needs to be taken care of. However, you know, you can have rental zoning, but if all those rentals aren't affordable, it doesn't really do anything. So that's why I say it's not a panacea on its own. It's a tool. And we will be using that tool where we can. Your first question was around
the reserve fund.
The reserve fund. Bank. The people have the idea that the reserve fund, it's set aside and can't be used for operations. So it's set aside for specific things within the city. We have fallen behind in building our infrastructure, and so all that money is set aside for infrastructure. And we have moved forward very quickly here with four major projects, starting with an ice rink, which we hope shovels will be in the ground by June, to start moving that forward, and quickly followed by a swimming pool, another ice rink, and then a couple of community centers within the city. So, you know, that money can be spent very, very quickly mm-hmm. on infrastructure, and it should be. That's what it was set aside for. So just to clear up any illusions that that money cannot be used for operations within the city.
It's, could it be used to build social housing?
20% of that money is set aside to be used towards some kind of social housing. And those are some of the answers we'll be coming up with, hopefully, in the task force.
All right. Is there going to be any looking, because I know one thing our listeners are always, or a chunk of our urbanist listeners are really interested in, is kind of breaking through the single family preserve, the homes. And Burnaby is a very suburban community. There's a lot of single family homes. And I think one of the criticisms of the Metro Town development was the focus on replacing affordable low rises with towers. Is there a chance that's open to discussion in Burnaby?
Oh, it's very definitely open for discussion. I mean, you know, our single-family homes and our single-family areas are very desired by many people within the city. But I also think that there's a realism that we cannot carry on, you know, in certain areas with just single-family homes, that we need to, you know, look at all the different models of housing. And that includes, you know, some apartments, and but certainly we need to be looking at townhomes. We need to be looking at row homes, co-ops. You know, there's many different models out there that I think that after the task force does its work, that we'll be starting down that path of the types of homes that young families, for example, are looking for, the types of homes that our seniors as they age could move to and be comfortable in. So, you know, We've had a bit of a narrow focus on the high rise, the 600 square foot apartment that works for some, but certainly does not work for all of our people here in Burnaby. So we really need to focus on having more variety within our housing stock, and certainly more affordable variety at that.
Well, let's look at transit for a minute. In Surrey and Vancouver, there's a lot of talk of SkyTrain expansion. Burnaby is obviously blessed with a lot of SkyTrain, not as much as New West per capita, I think, but it's probably not on your agenda. Meanwhile, in West Van, for example, they're revolting over the possibility a B-line might expand. What are your visions for transit in Burnaby, particularly if the 10-year plan is open to renegotiation, as it seems to be?
Well, one of the new 10, what's on part of the new 10-year plan is the thought of a gondola or a sky bus or whatever it's called to Simon Fraser, which, you know, although it would have to go through a lot of public consultation before we could get there, certainly that's going to be on the agenda with TransLink and the Mayor's Council. You know, there is some reticence to that amongst our own community. So those concerns would have to be addressed. So that is one thing, you know. Transportation to Simon Fraser at certain times of the year becomes a real issue.
Yeah, I was a student at SFU.
You know, there are many kids or many students who are seeing four bus waits to get up there, and sometimes buses don't even run. So it's certainly an issue we have to address, and that's part of it. You mentioned SkyTrain and the Evergreen Line, you know, and I've gone over there to watch this because I've had some complaints about it, is that we have two cars on that line during rush hour. And there are a lot of waits there because the trains are full by the time they get to Burnaby. TransLink have committed that new cars will be on that track by the end of the year. So hopefully we'll start to see many four-car trains, which will cut down on the waits at SkyTrain stations during hours. So that's one thing we've been pushing hard. Now, you're right, we're pretty blessed with SkyTrain, at least going east-west. Mm-hmm. But our challenges are also going north-south, and the routes going north-south. And we will keep pushing transit to up the services going that way as much as we can. But at the same time, you know, the other communities look at us and say, you don't really have much to complain about. You're pretty well served by transit. So, but that will not stop us from pushing for what we need for our citizens.
Do you think there's a need for more bike infrastructure or pedestrian infrastructure in the city? I know one of the things I've noticed since moving from Vancouver is a lot of the major intersections seem to prioritize cars over traffic or over pedestrians, and you have to like push the button to make sure you can get through. Are there changes that you're looking at or that the city is looking at in terms of walking or biking?
Yes. I think we need to look at walking and biking as more of a major transportation mode within the city. And one of the first things we've done here is we're going to close the northbound lane over the Gilmore Overpass, which has been a bit of a block for many people choosing to ride their bike to work, especially at the hospital, at EA Sports, and at BCIT, which are major work areas within our city. So we're doing a bike lane only path along there, and that's the start of improving our bicycling and walking infrastructure, which we will commit to be more aggressive on as we move forward.
So getting all of these new ideas through council must be challenging as you're an independent and you're faced with 7 members of the Burnaby Citizens Association, the legacy party, I guess, of Derek Corrigan and Joe Keithley, the Green. How are you finding the interpersonal dynamics of this council?
Well, you know, I've been around the politics here in Burnaby for 25 years, so I've got to know many of the councillors really well over that time. And, you know, they're people that care a lot about Burnaby as well. And when good ideas come forward, we certainly have discussions about it. But when the ideas are well received, they get well supported. So overall, it's been pretty positive on council. And obviously, it would be easier if I had more full support within council. But we are getting things done, and we are working well together as a council. And in fairness, these councillors care a lot about the city as well. So I think we're doing okay.
You might not want to name names, but do you have natural allies on council that you're starting to build better relationships with?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly Joe Keithley I work very well with. Him and I have a lot in common. We haven't been around actually being a politician for as long as the rest. So we have a good working relationship. We're very plain talking. But certainly there are people within the BCA Council that I can work very well with as well. And you're right, I won't name names. But, you know, as they say, all these councillors care about their community. And when ideas come forward that we all agree on, then we can get it through.
All right, well, just a few quick questions. You don't need to go into depth on any of these. You mentioned Councillor Keithley already, and as you know, his past was in the band DOA, and his nickname there was Joey Shithead Keithley. Yep. It's been ruled by you that using the word obstructionist in council is out of order. Would someone be able to call him Councillor Shithead, endearingly, let's say?
Well, I would likely rule that out of order within the council chamber as well. Unless it was really endearingly, but, you know, it's just not the type of language that I see that belongs in a council chamber.
It was reported in the Burnaby Now that you're going to be playing with Joey Keithley at the Burnaby Arts Council, I believe. Do you have a name for your band?
No, Joey actually announced that without actually telling me about it.
So it sounded like.
But we're looking forward. It'll be a bit of fun, and I don't think we're going to have a name. It's just going to be a bit of fun on the evening, and we'll see where it goes from there.
When we interviewed Kennedy Stewart before the election, he talked about how he had played in a band when he was younger, and he played bass. Would you consider inviting him to join your little duo?
I haven't given that any consideration, but might be something worth looking at.
Just on Burnaby itself, what's your favorite park in the city?
Well, I'm a little biased because I live right by Robert Burnaby Park, and they back onto that park. So I spent a lot of time there. But we have many beautiful parks, but I would have to say Robert Burnaby is my favorite.
All right. Well, that's all my time, so thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting interview there, Ian. I thought it's funny because he doesn't talk like a politician yet. You know, he's open to interest to ideas. He's willing to engage and talk about different policies that may be considered, you know, a third rail. Like he talked about possibly rezoning single family housing areas, which is normally, you know, Derek Corgan certainly wouldn't have answered that question in any kind of a meaningful way. And most politicians in the Lower Mainland would have difficulty answering it. But he seemed interested in looking at the issue.
So, Kelvin, you've been covering Burnaby City Hall pretty extensively because it's your job.
Yep.
What's been your impression of Hurley so far?
You're exactly right. Like, whenever I talk to him and I ask him about all these different issues, I get the impression that he's telling me exactly what he thinks. And he's just saying, like, how he feels about a subject and you know, what his thoughts are on it and where things may be going and you know, where things are at. And, you know, it sounds silly, but it's pretty unusual for a politician. I never have got really the sense. I mean, certainly he's trying to, you know, promote his plan and make himself, you know, appear like he's doing what's been asked of him. But yeah, he certainly seems open-minded and sort of dedicated to sort of what he's promised. And he's, you know, he certainly came in on a big change vote. I mean, his campaign slogan was "Time for Change," and he toppled Derek Corgan, who was mayor for a long time. And, you know, he's sort of in his sort of composure and the way he goes about things, he's a pretty sort of mild-mannered kind of conservative guy, not necessarily in policy, but just sort of in his way of approaching things. And I think some people might be finding that a little bit frustrating. I've certainly heard that from some people. When it comes to housing, his answer is, well, the task force is looking at it. Well, what about this issue? Oh, the task force is going to look at it. Wait 6 months. And some people are finding that end of things pretty frustrating.
That seems to be pretty common in the region after this last election, is I think we had a lot of elected politicians and going into the last election who had been in municipal politics for quite a while, had gotten used to the things they could and couldn't say. And now, you know, in Vancouver, you have a bunch of city councillors who really are very open about what they believe, where they want to see things going. Some of them a little gratingly so, but, you know, by and large, they're all fairly honest actors. You see the same thing in a number of other municipalities, the District of North Vancouver and West Vancouver, those city councillors, you know, on their opinions about, you know, social housing, are very open about being willing to vote against it, for example. And it's funny, it's almost like because we have a bunch of new elected people all across the region, it's much more open and honest about the discourse.
Why do we do this? Like, why do politicians do this? And why does the public demand a, as you say, Patrick, there be some kind of would or would not, or can or cannot say? Like, what exactly is that coming from? I'm getting a little meta here, but I'm curious as to, like, how you take what seemed like a relatively fresh-faced group of young councillors back in 2008 and slowly hammer them into molds of what you call a standard politician. And I'm just interested in, like, one, where the rules come from, and two, why that happens.
I think, to jump in there, I think the easiest way is it's really easy to say, yeah, let's rezone this area for mid-rise development. And everyone's like, yeah, that's a great idea. And, you know, it sounds really good. And then the first project hits a public hearing. And then you go through that public hearing. And the next project hits a public hearing. And you go through that public hearing. And then, you know, a bike lane gets proposed in an area over an overpass in Burnaby or in Vancouver. And the bicycling advocates hate it. Or the public hates it. And then you have to deal with the fallout from what you thought was a pretty simple thing. And over the course of a few years, you've gone through all these, the devil in the details, painful public hearings, and all of a sudden you just don't want to talk about that issue anymore. And I think we're even starting to hear that with Rental 100 in Vancouver, where city councillors are getting tired of talking about it.
I mean, we're getting tired.
I mean, I'm tired of talking about it.
Tired, yes.
But we will talk about it later. First of all, let's talk about housing in Burnaby. In the interview, and you already mentioned it, Hurley talked about this task force he's put together. People are frustrated because it feels like Burnaby elected a change mayor to try to do something quickly, and he did stop dem evictions, sort of put a moratorium on that. What is this task force actually doing? Is there any like noise out of it yet, or is it literally just been formed?
So it's just been formed. They've met three or four times now, and there's been a lot of You know, they've had like these community workshops where they got like 100 citizens together from all walks of life into a room together to discuss different options and what they want to see. So there's a report coming to council on Monday that's like the what we heard sort of update. I haven't seen it yet, but it's sort of just, I think, going to summarize sort of the different views that they've heard. And then at the 3-month mark, it started in February, so at the 3-month mark, they're going to have an interim report that's supposed to have like sort of like the fast action items that they can sort of start working on right away. And then 3 months after that, there's going to be a final report that is supposedly going to sort of, you know, lay the groundwork for, you know, years to come to make housing more affordable on council. But you know, councillor Paul McDonnell, who's a longtime BCA councillor who was reelected in October, you know, he told me the other day, he's like, well, I don't think they're going to come up with anything that we haven't already thought about. And he, you know, he said like it's you know, there's not some like magical silver bullet for the housing that somehow, you know, a random group of, you know, citizens and developers and activists are going to suddenly happen upon.
You mean you can't reinvent the wheel?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's certainly a sentiment that's out there. You know, Hurley obviously would push back on that. But so it's I think Hurley's sort of having a trying to find that balance there.
Right.
But, you know, and he keeps on saying like, well, that interim report's going to be here soon. So I think we're going to probably, I think everybody, including the mayor, is going to be eager to actually be able to show people that they're actually taking, you know, sort of concrete steps soon after that 3-month report's out.
Yeah, on those concrete steps, it seems fairly clear to me, you know, Burnaby didn't build any social housing for a long time. It seems clear to me this council is planning on at least building some.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Well, when I asked him about the $1 billion they have in the bank, you know, he talked about how crumbling their infrastructure is, how much they need to put into community centers and all that. And that money has to be spent on capital projects. They can't just throw it at programs, and that's fine. But I did say, well, what about affordable housing? Can't you spend some on there? And he's like, well, 20 or 30% is set aside.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some stuff in the pipeline. You know, they just sort of had a reveal of a new BC Housing development in the Edmonds area the other day. And I think that one is like, it's quite a bit. It was like more than 30 units, I think. And it's, you know, it's 1, 2, 3, and even 4-bedroom units, which I've actually never even heard of before.
4-bedroom units.
There's like 2 or 3 4-bedroom units.
Wow.
Yeah. So they were really, you know, proud. And so it was an interesting event because they sort of had a groundbreaking on a seniors development and sort of like a ribbon cutting for this other one. And the two together are replacing a really old and outdated seniors housing complex in the area. So everyone that was in that seniors complex moved into a brand new building. And then there's a new one starting, so it's actually going to be a 2-to-1 replacement.
Okay.
When all is said and done, and you know, and Hurley and especially some of the older councillors, they're really, you know, they don't like that narrative of like, oh, you haven't done anything. And you know, Colleen Jordan, who's a longtime councillor who was sort of chaired the planning committee and was at the head of the housing file for years. You know, she says like, well, you know, you bring up, you know, the city has built X amount of rental units. And she's like, well, that's true, but there's like 1,000 in the pipeline. And so there's not nothing happening, but it's certainly slower than a lot of people would like.
Well, and on that investment, sort of that investment fund that Burnaby has, you know, it's a huge amount of money. But Francis Bueller talked about it in our podcast, you know, during the election. Was everyone thinks the Vancouver Investment Fund, which has got a huge amount of money and it can be used to solve all the problems. Well, you know, the money's locked away in some 3, 5-year, 10-year bonds. You know, there's different investment portfolios that it's in. It's turning in a profit right now of some amount of money. Same thing in Burnaby. This money is sitting in a bank account. It's not. This money's not sitting in a mattress. It's sitting in an investment portfolio that's return. It's having a return on investment that the city's going to be is using that. It's earmarked for certain projects over a window of time, and so it's not like you can just take that $1 billion and just be like, "All right, nothing but affordable rental."
Yeah, sounds like an endowment, actually. Like it's being used somewhat as an endowment.
I mean, technically, cities aren't supposed to have that.
No, they have investment funds.
Yeah, but in Burnaby, like, Curly told me straight up, he's like, I'm going to spend it.
Good.
Basically.
Good.
He said like that. And like most of that money is coming from like community amenity contributions, like density bonuses. Yeah. Most of it like in Metrotown and the 3 other town centers. And because they're moving forward right now on 4 major projects. They're 4 different community centers. They're either replacing or completely redeveloping. And he's saying like with this moratorium he's put on like big projects and stuff, that money's not really coming in anymore. So he basically told him, he's like, yeah, I'm going to spend, and it's at $1.7 billion right now.
Jeez. But to actually make that spending happen, he's going to need allies. And as I talked about with him on the interview, he's an independent with a very BCA-dominated council. But you've done some good reporting that that may be showing some fissures.
Yeah, it's been really interesting for me to see, you know, how those dynamics have played out since the election. Because, you know, before the election, and you know, I was only covering that council for a few months because I only got to Burnaby, to the Burnaby Now, a few months before the election. But for me, like, I didn't go to actually most council meetings. I'd watch the video the next day, but I wouldn't go because there was no discussion on anything. Every single issue, you know, and if there was anything even said about an item, it would just be a council would be like, yeah, I think this is great because we're great and this is a great idea.
And, to be fair, if everyone has done their pre-readings, they may not. You could actually do a very efficient meeting and, like, decide it by email before. But I think you're getting to the broader point that it wasn't.
Yeah, but I didn't have no idea. I had no idea who is who. I had no idea that Sav Dhaliwal, for example, who's now the head of the Metro Board, like, that he's just, like, this really knowledgeable, like, smart, like, guy that's just, like, he's clearly, like, you know, all over this stuff. And he understands policy, you know, really in depth. And he's really good at explaining things and, you know, arguing a certain point of view and stuff. Like, I had no idea because he was dead silent the entire time. And so now, you know, you have, and Councillor, we were talking about earlier, Colleen Jordan, you know, she had a great quote the other day. She said, there's been a division of loyalties at the table.
That's so staggering.
I know.
Yeah.
And really there has. So there's been, you know, Sav Dhaliwal, Pietro Calandino, both BCA, they've really, you know, got on board with Hurley's plan. They're both on the housing task force, and there's been a number of issues, mostly from Colleen Jordan and another councillor, Dan Johnson, is sort of been allied with her. One of the councillors at one point said the two of them has gone rogue. And
but these are the veteran councillors, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the veteran councillors have gone, like, kind of reactionary rogue.
Well, no, again, not all of them, because no, yeah, Sav Dhaliwal had been on council for a number of years before that.
No, there's, like, so a lot of them, most of them have been on council for a really long time.
Most of council was re-elected, wasn't it?
There were seven councillors left, because one had left, Ann Kang had left to be an MLA. Yep. All seven got re-elected. That one empty seat didn't go to the BCA, went to Joe Keithley.
Right.
So they're all there during the Derek Corrigan era.
They all nodded their heads and voted with the party.
Yeah, and so Colleen Jordan, you know, she's tried to, you know, stop or change direction on a number of housing policy things. They're sort of opening up like cellars to, so you can have a full cellar, and the idea is to you know, have more basement suites. She's sort of tried to throw a wrench in that a few times.
Oh, interesting. And refunding the oven tax, as I heard.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting one, and I was kind of surprised that there was much opposition to that, but I guess she was upset about that. I think on the grounds that she said that this applied to her. So the idea is like they tax what they call the oven tax, which is like their way
the
of identifying when there's a secondary suite. And so during the campaign, Hurley said, "Oh, this is an unfair tax. It's unfair." He said, especially to families if you have, like, say a kid with a disability who's, like, living in your basement suite and they have some sort of autonomy, but they're not paying rent. Mm-hmm. You know, you're paying an extra 50% on utilities to have that. So he promised something, and his sort of plan to address it has changed. So they're going to refund anybody who's paid it this year if they don't have any rental revenue from it.
Oh, so they're still going to nail the people with secondary suites. They're just not going to.
Yeah, it's just the idea. Yes.
Idea is, so this is like halfway to normal policy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's normal in other cities, but.
Well, I don't think they tax ovens.
Yeah, the oven thing is interesting, but I guess the way Corrigan explained it to me was, you know, we don't want to go on a witch hunt for all the illegal secondary suites in the city. So this is our way of recouping sort of the extra use of utilities without, you know, cracking down.
And who conducts the oven census?
I think, like, it's the same people who do the TV licensing fee in the UK. They drive vans around with oven detectors.
All of that joking. Checks out. Checks out. Source for facts here on the Canby Report. Please stay tuned for more on Burnaby's next oven census.
But it does seem really interesting that you've got this sort of, you know, and we're going to talk about it now, I think, is this, like, Hurley and Keithley get along quite well.
Yeah.
And it seems like, you know, several BCA counselors also really get along with them quite well, which is surprising given that they were the barbarian hordes at the gate enemy 6 months ago. Yeah. It's this realignment that seems to be really occurring.
Turns out that like the barbarians kind of had a point with pants and you know, their relative benefit over the toga.
And also weren't all that politically different from the BCA to begin with. Like, I don't think, like, Hurley could practically have always fit in with the BCA crowd.
As far as I could tell, it was like the election of the NDP competing with the two establishment NDP.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And, you know, I mean, with the demoviction thing, it just made so many people so mad. And you know, it was one thing what they were doing, but then there was also the rhetoric around it. And, you know, Corrigan was the face of it, but Colleen Jordan was as well. And you know, and people got the impression that they were just saying, oh, well, tough luck. We need to build some towers.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're out of a home. And
it's interesting that reverberated so well, because it would have had to, for it to have political effects, it would have had to have reverberated really well with people in single family homes.
Yeah.
And that means that those people, like the residents of Burnaby that are well-housed and have theirs, really realized how hurtful this policy was to people. And that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it was interesting to look at the voting results. And Hurley won at every single voting location throughout the whole city. So it wasn't as if it was just, you know, people in Metrotown that turned out in droves to like this guy. The whole city turned on this guy that was, you know, mayor for 16 years before that.
Well, I think one thing you see is people talking about, oh, my kids can't afford to live here now. Mm-hmm. And so that can really move boomer and older generations when they see that their millennials still have to either live in their illegal basement suite or move to Maple Ridge or beyond.
Still waiting for the District of North Vancouver to jump on that one, too.
Yeah.
That's funny that you mentioned that, because like me and some other reporters were laughing during the by-election campaign. Jagmeet Singh, he had this story. I've heard him tell this story at least 20 times now. And he's like, I came to this door and this mom said she was worried about housing. And, you know, I was like, oh, why are you worried about housing? You have a nice house. And then she's like, go get my daughter from the basement. And she had like a teacher daughter from the basement that you know, couldn't afford to live in Burnaby. And yeah, I've heard Singh say that story, I think, at least 20 times now. He's got it down to a T.
Where would you say that like cleavage is largely breaking down between the councillors aligned with the new mayor and what I will, I suppose, for lack of a better term, call the old Colleen Jordan's faction?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there an ideological or breakdown that's happening between the two that you can point to?
I don't know. I mean, I think... other than it just, like, I think a big part of it is just sort of personality, maybe. I think Colleen especially is, you know, we heard Hurley say that he's open to this idea of rezoning single family areas. You know, she is, I think, really adamant that that's just, like, not something we should be doing. And, you know, when the counselors herself and some others, when they've spoken about, you know, the way they've done things up until now, they actually take a lot of pride. And, you know, saying we've been able to protect single family areas and you know, densify around the city, the four city centers. You know, but the thing is the other three aren't so controversial, because the other three city centers, you haven't seen the same displacement.
There wasn't exactly much around Brentwood to begin with.
Yeah. And like, you might be displacing, like, I don't know, an old laundry or something like that. Yeah. You're not displacing, you know, a bunch of low-income immigrants or whatever.
The low rental stock of the Lower Mainland.
Yeah.
And who cares about that old laundry when it will soon be replaced by the amazing Brentwood, which is its actual name.
One of the other stories before we move off of Burnaby that you covered is this controversy around the perks that the politicians there get. And as far as I understand it, this is essentially the mayor and former mayors, councillors and former councillors, and essentially the elected politicians they appoint, and the school board, all get essentially unlimited access to Burnaby Parks and Rec facilities, which includes the city-owned golf courses.
Yeah, so that was something that, well before my time at the paper, but the Burnaby Now sort of revealed back in 2013. And you know, the top guy was a park commissioner. He basically got, like, I think it was $6,000 worth of free golf in a year. And Derek Corrigan was number two, and he wasn't far behind. And that blew up. You know, it certainly doesn't look good. It looks like they're, you know.
Why?
I mean.
Why? So, who says it doesn't look good?
the public.
Do they? So, was there a big grassroots movement that demanded an inquiry into the spending habits of the kind of people?
I imagine those stories did pretty well on your website.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't around at the time, but I think there was a pretty big uproar. People, it's the optics of it, right? It'd be one thing if they were using it to, like, you know, go do laps at the pool every morning, but I think golf has a certain connotation with it as well.
It's an elite thing. It looks like they're out of touch, entitled. It's one, like, I think we've talked on this pod about how we're in favor of politicians being fairly compensated financially for the work they do.
Yes, but that's not going to happen, so give them a pass to the rec facilities.
Well, and like I definitely agree that it's optically a bad thing to do because the public generally doesn't agree with that kind of thing. But I think to sort of the Tourism Vancouver Challenge Pass that exists in the tourism industry is the tourism industry in Vancouver, if you work in it, you get a Tourism Challenge Pass. And if in the month of May you go to a certain amount of tourism places in the Lower Mainland and you get in for free, you get a free pass for yourself to go to any tourism location that's a participating group in the city for a year. This is all across the Lower Mainland, in fact. It's a really neat program. The whole benefit of the program is that anybody that works in the tourism industry can tell a tourist where something else is and what they can find in that place. Now, in Burnaby, a city councilor, if they go and they use Bonzor and they use Burnaby 8 rinks and they go to this golf course, they know when these things come up to council to make a decision on, they know a little bit more about these facilities, would be, I would say, the argument in favor of this.
But so what council was looking at doing was capping this, maybe.
Yeah, so they were looking, the proposal was to eliminate it for some folks. So I think it would have eliminated the passes for like library board members, and it would have capped it. There was a total cap for the program at $55,000 a year. And then rather than that, they suggested a cap of $1,500 per person per year. And then also limiting, like, for some of them, like counselors and stuff, they could have like bring an unlimited number of guests. And then the proposal was to limit it to one guest, I guess, per trip.
So no more holding your birthday party at the golf course?
Yeah, I guess not.
I mean, sure, though I think it would be pretty reasonable to invite someone from the sister city and their whole delegation out to the golf course. Like, I don't know how these things were getting racked up, but it is within the realm of possibility that important people like to play golf together. And I would just like to remind everyone that optics only matter when viewing an object because of the lens you're putting on it. That's the whole...
Yeah.
I understood what you said. It's just entertaining.
But nevertheless, council decided to table consideration of this cap.
Yeah, so it was up for a vote, and one of the councilors said, oh, well, before we do it, let's find out what everybody else does. And we want to be in line with, you know, other municipalities in the region. And so the vote to table it did pass. I think it was 5-4. A lot of votes these days are 5-4, which is hard to believe. Would have been hard to believe under the old council. But so I think it's going to come up again on Monday, actually, and we'll see how things go.
All right.
And then during that week, the councilors all grabbed their bags and headed off to the golf course, only to be blocked by the myriad library board members who are already occupying the links.
Well, from the golf courses of Burnaby, we can take...
There's no good.
I don't know where the golf courses in Burnaby are, but you can get onto the SkyTrain and take it down the Evergreen Line and end up in Port Moody, where that city has been in the news. Who wants to try to explain what's happened with the mayor there?
So Mayor Vagramov has been, charges have been laid on an accusation of sexual assault that occurred sometime in 2015, if I recall correctly from the story. The charges were laid in a real bombshell last week. There had been some internet accusations that had come out during the election campaign that I've been told about reliably, the relatively controversial mayor Vagramov is now taking a leave of absence, a paid leave of absence, as is his right to do under the rules, from the being mayor of Port Moody in order to step away and deal with the charges and then come back if the charges are
cleared.
Now, if the charges aren't cleared, if he's convicted, I'm definitely not using proper legal terms, but if he is convicted, he also still isn't removed as mayor unless he chooses to resign because the rules don't allow for it. So the city council had an emergency meeting wherein they had to debate who would be the acting mayor in his absence. Now, the city council is divided relatively evenly between his supporters and his opponents. And he had a majority vote with him voting, and now it was a tie vote, more or less, between his supporters and his opponents. And the argument was, the argument used on some of them was that it should be their group because we should respect the voters, was used as an argument. You know, the voters had elected somebody of Vagramov's political opinions, and so that those political opinions should get the seat. The other side said, well, screw you, it's now 3-3. so why not? And so in the end, they...
I admire that just willingness to use raw political power based on, like, very unfortunate circumstances.
Yeah, well, and so now, and so the compromise is that they are going to do a rotating cast of mayors, and the order was determined out of... Now, initially reported as a hat that they drew from a hat. Now, it is important to clarify that it was, in fact, not a hat. It was a water glass that they drew from because this had become a bit of an issue. But that's, in a nutshell, the issue that we've now got before us.
How on earth did it become a bit of an issue?
Well, see, Justin McElroy was watching the live feed and getting very excited on Twitter. And as soon as he found out that it was going to be by random lot, he just assumed it was out of a hat. And he started reporting on that on his Twitter live feed right away. And everyone picked it up on it. And leads were written about how it was drawn from a hat. Somebody wanted to know what kind of a hat it was. Perhaps, a bowler or a baseball cap.
Closer to a bowl than a bowler.
And in the end, Justin had to retract his incorrect statement and clarify that it was, in fact, a water glass. And he couldn't quite see on the live feed, as those of us that have watched City Council live feeds can attest. It's not exactly watching, the NHL on high def.
Well, and this isn't the first BC mayor in the last year to be drawn essentially at random. I think the election result in Peachland was a dead tie in October. And the Local Government Act specifies that in that situation, you draw it by lot. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't use a hat, but I think they used like a briefcase or some other kind of thing where they
put... There are two briefcases. Select one.
I think they put both names on a piece of paper and put them in one.
There are 10 briefcases. Select one, then we're going to remove three, and then you can choose whether or not to switch briefcases.
The Monty Hall mayor.
But this is also not the first mayor to be accused of a criminal act or to have criminal charges laid against him. And it's really highlighting a motion that is going towards UBCM, Union of BC Municipalities, which is calling for the province to, for certain serious criminal accusations to have a requirement that they step aside. Because right now, if Mayor Vagramov had chosen to do, he could have continued to be mayor while the charges were underway.
That would be a good way to get these changes moved much faster through the legislature, I imagine.
Absolutely. And so it really does highlight the idea that there is no ability really to remove a mayor or a councillor in BC.
I was checking court appearances, and as it turns out, he's been in court a lot, but it's mostly violation tickets, which just provides me with the opportunity to remind you to always contest your violation tickets.
Well, and Vagramov is also has been significantly controversial in the past. There's a YouTube video of him offering a free meal to a homeless guy in exchange for if the homeless guy were willing to shotgun a beer.
Yeah, he's like...
He's the youngest mayor in BC.
He's like the jackass mayor. It's like the mayor from Jackass that took over Port Coquitlam. It's an embarrassing... Port Moody. Yeah. I don't know.
He's also been quite obstructionist at the mayor's council, where he was quite...
Port Coquitlam Provincial Court. Keeps turning up, sorry.
Quite verbose about SNC-Lavalin at one of the mayor's council meetings and talking about attempting to find ways to prevent the new Saskatchewan lines from being built using SNC-Lavalin, which...
That sounds like prejudicing the contract.
It's not exactly a good thing to say out loud in a public hearing or a public meeting.
A private meeting.
Yeah. And so, he's not without controversy. And so now he's stepping aside and they've now got an acting mayor.
Yeah, we didn't get much chance to cover Port Moody during the election with everything going on. But it was one of those things where it was definitely a hot race between, I think a lot of people liked some of the ideas he was talking about, but then looked at him and went, but he's an asshole. Or seems like it. And
yes, that is.
That was essentially the Port Moody election.
Hector Bremner was making a milder version of the same bet.
But this guy won.
Yeah.
And actually, if we push along a little bit farther, not on the Evergreen Line, we'd have to get on the B line that is potentially going to be coming in soon to Maple Ridge. You know, the Maple Ridge that we covered at our last podcast, where they had their homeless tent city that has now been replaced by, or is going to be replaced by, temporary modular housing in a couple of months. Seems like Premier Horgan has something to say about cities that aren't willing to take provincial support. He had some pretty firm words. First thing he did was he double-barreled against Maple Ridge and said, you know, they don't want to have a homeless village, but they don't want to have social housing, so what do you want to do? And we're going to just do it, which is what they're doing. And he also said that cities that get an investment in rapid transit, if they don't densify, well, they may not get that rapid transit. He says essentially that if you want rapid transit, if you want the province to make major investments in your city in terms of transportation, you'd better be willing to rezone around that, because you shouldn't get a major transit infrastructure without actually utilizing it and leveraging it for a better city.
It's interesting that, like, this is effectively a, like, full endorsement of the urban philosophy of Vancouverism, which is a term that was not come up with in Vancouver, but it was used to describe how development happened around SkyTrain stations, like how the transit got built and the zoning allowed for increased densification around these stations. In this case, like, it is very much enforcing that, like, down to the bus level and out into the environs.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see if the province starts to step up as we get into the Broadway line development, as well as, you know, further rapid transit expansion throughout the region, whether or not the province starts to say that there's strings attached to that funding.
All right, so we've decided to take the hypothetical beeline in entirely the wrong direction and have ended up in Maple Ridge, but we have to dash back to Vancouver and dash through it. So let us begin. The Vancouver Housing Data Book. What is it?
So Metro Vancouver has been publishing a housing data book for 15 or 20 years now, and I've used it a lot in my work life, and I use it a lot for looking up how building is happening in the Lower Mainland. Relatively recently, in the last couple of years, the City of Vancouver has been putting out their own data book, which is, you know, how much new development occurred in what price points, which became a real public point of interest, as well as, you know, what else is being built, where it's being built, how many laneway houses have been built, where they are. It turns out most of them are in the southeast corner of the city. Or at least a good chunk of them seem to be focusing in there, stuff like that. And so it's a really fascinating eye window into what's going on in terms of housing development.
This became a particularly political this week, as Vancouver had set out a number of goals for mm-hmm. each range. And they're actually doing really great on some of those goals.
Yep.
But those happen to be where people have lots of money.
Or where people have very little
or
money.
Or very little.
Because they're also exceeding their goal on people with household incomes of $0 to $16,000 a year. And the reason they're doing that is primarily, and this is what Vision Vancouver said for years, was that the province and the feds aren't at the table. Well, the province is now at the table at that income band and building 600 temporary modular housing units, which has allowed them to get to a point of exceeding their goal on that income band for housing development.
But on the upper end, high market condos for
$80,000 income household and above is doing quite well. Right, well, so the $80,000 to $110,000 band, I think it is actually still underperforming from its goal significantly. Purpose-built rental at $80,000 to $100,000 a year of income household is still at 50% of the targeted goal. Because at the end of the day, rental 100 is hard for a developer to make the numbers work.
Versus a condo or
versus
other
building a
ways
condo.
They could do it.
Yeah.
And where things are really struggling is that $30,000 to $80,000 income band.
Zero privately built housing units at that income, targeting that income band, were built.
That doesn't mean zero new units opened up, but new private developments.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's the real question. You know, the numbers, it's hard because we don't have the data on it. But the assumptions, and it's a fair assumption, mostly because I say that because anecdotally I did it, is people move out of low-cost basement suites when they have decent decent incomes when that housing gets built. And when a rental 100 unit gets built at $1,800 a month, if you can afford that and you want to get out of your $1,100 a month basement suite, you do. And then that basement suite is still rented out at $1,100 a month to somebody at a lower income.
Now, it's worth pointing out the median income in the city of Vancouver for a household is in that band. It's in the $60,000 to $70,000 range. I forget the exact number, but I saw it bandied
about.
It's
up there. And it depends on how you slice those numbers. It's usually the $53,000 household median gets thrown out a lot, but oftentimes I've seen the number higher to closer to 70 or 75.
Yeah. But in either case, that's not being well served by the new developments.
Yeah, we're not building new housing for those people is the problem.
Huh. I mean, you would think that economics would try and create supply where there was unmet demand, but God forbid something sensible happen. Counselors responded.
Yes, Adrian Carr and Pete Fry responding the way they continue to reply, which is that we're not building the right supply and we need to, you know, freeze rental 100, and which is the, which, you know, we need to freeze rental 100 and move forward with a new project. They haven't really identified much in the way of a new project yet, but they clearly have an issue. Lisa Dominato is really keen on townhouse expansion. One of the interesting things is that townhouse expansion is there's very little of it. And staff did point out that up until last year, I think it was, only 3% of all the properties in Vancouver were zoned to allow townhouse development. And so there isn't a lot of it because they didn't allow it. But that's starting to open up and townhouse development is starting to happen. Melissa DeGeneva, Sarah Kirby-Young, and Christine Boyle all asked really interesting pointed questions to really illuminate what Rental 100 is doing in terms of its limitations, in terms of like scale, because it's only building 1,500 to 2,000 units a year, as well as its limitations in terms of the ability to get affordable pricing.
And Gene Swanson really highlighted the need for more social housing, and that even mm-hmm. though we're doing well with the temporary modular homes, there are still homeless people. And I think what was her perfect yep. question of just like, well, are targets good enough then?
Yeah, why are our targets lower than the, why are our targets for housing homeless people lower than the number of homeless people?
That is a good question, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the question, right? Like, and I saw, you know, if your target in 2018-19 is to build an amount of social housing, should you make that target a target that's above what you think you're going to do so that you push to get to it? Or are you going to make that target the max, the perfect, right?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's based on the capacity of a city to do something.
That too, right?
So, yeah. Like, don't it's set called, unrealistic yeah. targets if you have no chance of meeting them. But mm-hmm. you can have stretch goals.
Meanwhile, March had the lowest...
Just like you can on patreon.com/CambyReport.
Meanwhile, March had the lowest real estate sales rate in something like 25 years in Metro Vancouver. And so we are continuing to see an unstable housing market. And we don't know where things are going to go in the next year. But, you know, obviously, the more you build social housing, the better. And the more you build, you know, housing that's targeted for people at lower income bands, the better.
So what was the vote at City Council that broke down along a alignment that I had not seen so far? And that was reconceptualize the Rental 100 program, and everyone was in favor except for Gene Swanson, which is unsurprising, and Michael Wiebe, which is not a pairing that I would have expected.
So it's unclear what Michael Wiebe's intentions were. So the vote was to refer it to staff for a report, which seems to happen a lot. It's possible that Michael Wiebe was voting against it because he just didn't want to support the thing at all. It's unclear to me right now where he was on that one. The reconceptualizing was essentially to freeze rental 100, or at least perhaps only freeze the DCL or the development cost levy component of the rental 100 program, perhaps. But also perhaps it's, you know, just to freeze the program altogether. So they referred to staff to report back on what the consequences of that might be, what the impact would be, what, you know, what else could be done. And that went through. And Gene Swanson said, no, we need to do this now.
So either Michael Wiebe hates Rental 100 and wants to get rid of it even more than his two green colleagues and has not been vocal about it, or he doesn't want to, or he just wants to stop talking about it.
Counselor Wiebe, give us a call and message on our voicemail, or otherwise get in touch and tell us what you're thinking, because you're probably listening.
So the Rental 100 obviously came up again at Council. Swanson's pushing the motion. It sounds like Pete Fry and Adrian Carr are maybe developing. They keep talking about how they're going to move a motion, but they keep not doing it. And that's, you know, just to segue for a quick second, you know, we've seen Christine Boyle come forward with some incisive motions on climate action and things like that. We've seen Michael Wiebe come forward with like really clear motions on environmental issues in terms of waterways and greenways in the city. We've seen, you know, Hardwick and Swanson come forward with really clear position motions that set aside policy alternatives. We've seen, you know, Rebecca Bly with the school tax.
Clear positioned, I like as a
yeah. But what's interesting is we're seeing a lot of talk coming from Councillors Carr and Fry, and not a lot of motions. They really keep talking about how they want to get something done, but neither of them are really putting together a lot in the way of motions. They have had one or two, but they're not really setting out like clear policy outcomes through motions at council.
So this is I want to like step back from this and just wonder, is this the kind of issue that can bog a council down and really start to one, divide a council that up until now has been working relatively well together, especially since it is a non-majority council led by an independent. And, like, where do we start to worry that this is going to jeopardize the other stuff that Vancouver City Council is trying to achieve, just in terms of, like, the operational structure of council? Because it is,
no,
like,
you're,
it's just
you've got a really good point.
On.
It's, and I said that, you know, it's all these people that want to fight Rental 100, they have forced council to spend, you know, say 30 hours debating Rental 100, and that probably doesn't even count the public hearings where they debate Rental 100 again. It's forcing staff to write report after report, and, you know, it's all being condensed into one large report that keeps getting larger, but they keep adding more things for that report. So how much of that time could have gone into, you know, advocating and fighting for a real program that could replace Rental 100, or could, you know, augment or supplement Rental 100 program that would target the income bands that they want to target?
I'm like almost at the point, especially once I start reading people who get like virulently in favor of Rental 100, that I'm just like, why don't we just blow it up and move on? Would that make people happy? Obviously not. But...
Sorry, did you mean the large swaths of single family detached housing in Vancouver? Because yes,
yeah, blow those up too.
Yeah.
I mean, if Burnaby can consider doing it.
Well, and there is a counter program to Rental 100 that is starting to see action, which is the
MIRP.
The MIRP, MIRHPP.
And we have settled on MIRP as the sounding out of that.
Yeah, yes, MIRP, as Dan Fumano pointed out in his really excellent article that we can link in the show notes. It rhymes with burp. So there's a project that's going forward. The Denny's project is the one that's really the primary one, which is Denny's on West Broadway. And that this MIRP program is 20% of housing units get dedicated. 20% of the floor space of a new rental building has to go to genuinely low cost rental. This would be at, you know, 30% of the median income rental. And so this is, instead of all units having to be slightly below market, it's, you know, 1 in 5 units have to be well below market. And there's a lot of applications. And one of the applications going forward now is in Kitsilano, which is to build a 5-story, 60-something unit rental building, which, as Judy Osborne, who owns a heritage house a block away from the street site and is organizing neighborhood opposition, says, "You're dropping the ghetto in Kitsilano."
Class.
I'm out.
That's like the ghetto. You're dropping the ghetto in Kitsilano. And so even these programs that are better than Rental 100 in the eyes of some people in terms of actually providing, you know, some units that are, you know, if it's 60 units and 20% of them have to be well below market, you're adding not a lot, but some units that are genuinely affordable.
The real question is, of course, whether that statement was racist, anti-Semitic, or merely classist.
All of the above?
It's fascinating to see just how much anger is coming out over like a 5-story building in a neighborhood that, you know, as Brandon Yan, who's actually in the Dan Fumano article, points out, there are higher buildings within a block of it.
So Vancouver continues to spin its tires in the mud of housing policy, not knowing where to go.
Yeah. And some people think that a 60-unit rental building in Kitsilano is like the ghetto.
Vancouver will always be itself.
I'm literally broken. I have no more time for Vancouver, which is convenient because we've reached Vancouverada and don't have to deal with it. Who was Robert Burnaby?
Yeah, so I thought it'd be interesting, since we talked about Burnaby with Mike Hurley and we've talked about it with you here, Kelvin, to actually look at who is the guy that the city is named after. Hurley also mentioned his favorite park is Robert Burnaby Park, which is not part of Deer Lake or Burnaby Lake Park, the two biggest, but if you cross the highway from Burnaby Lake, you get into Robert Burnaby Park. So that gives you a sense of where it is.
It's pretty easy to do if you do it at between like 1 a.m. and 3 a.m, I'm pretty sure.
I thought you were going to
and you run really
cars.
Fast. You play Frogger, essentially. So it turns out Robert Burnaby actually has more things named after him in this province than anyone else. There's 11 different landmarks, according to Wikipedia, that includes an island in Haida Gwaii,
like
where it's not clear he ever visited. There's also a channel, randomly, and a few other bits and bobs across the province. So, Patrick, who was Robert Burnaby?
So I didn't really know anything about Robert Burnaby prior to this coming up as the Vancouverada, and neither, I think, Kelvin, you didn't know either.
Yeah, no, I had no idea. I knew that there was a guy named Robert Burnaby, and I know there's a plaque at City Hall I've walked by. I was like, oh, yeah, there's a guy. Like, I should figure out what his deal is at some point, but I'm learning here today.
So on a very basic level, Robert Burnaby was an English settler colonialist in BC. He was born in 1828 in England, and he died in 1878 in England. So like all true 19th century lower mainland settler colonial white guys from England, he came in, he made a lot of money, he went home, and he died there.
During his life here in BC, or what would become BC, he's most famous for being the private secretary to Richard Clement Moody, who was the, quote, founder and first lieutenant governor of British Columbia.
He was also an MLA in the Vancouver Island Colony before unification of Vancouver Island Colony and whatever the colony of the mainland was at the time.
But perhaps his most lasting legacy will live on in his brokering an uneasy peace between the English and Scottish lodges of the Freemasons.
Oh yeah, I guess we forgot to mention that one off the hopper, is that much like a lot of white settler colonials in the Lower Mainland, he was also a Freemason.
Not just any Freemason. He was essentially the King Freemason of BC.
Grand Wizard? Oh, wait, no, they don't. That's not the organization that, that uses that title.
It's a different organization of white people. This, he was the District Grand Master.
Which isn't actually all that far.
And I guess at the time, there was tensions between the English and Scottish Freemasons, which I know you're working on a BC politics history podcast, Patrick. I think you need to have a diversion episode in your plan for Freemason history in the province.
Absolutely.
And
important.
Other new religious.
Have you seen the Freemason building in Victoria?
The ley lines that they've.
Yo, have you seen the Freemason building in Victoria?
I have not.
It's very impressive looking.
They always tend to be. You know, yes. There is a Freemason building in Vancouver, but we'll have to talk about that a different time.
Where is it?
Granville and 10th.
No more Vancouver. It's Burnaby.
So, Mr. Burnaby did manage to do a poll of the Freemasons in the province and found actually pretty good support for amalgamation, and in October 1871 managed to get them together. He declined, though, to be the Grand Master of the new Grand Lodge.
To me, it just sounds like chess.
Because he was in poor health, and instead he became the past Grand Master.
So when we talk about like renaming things to either modernize them or to actually indigenize and contribute to reconciliation, I really wonder why we care about keeping names like, you know, this guy Burnaby, he was just a businessman who went home to England. You know, Burrard never once set foot in the Pacific Northwest. He was just a naval drinking buddy of George Vancouver. Like, why do we, you know, or like the really classic Dude Chilling Park, where everyone then asked, well, what was it originally? And no one could name the park as Guelph Park, but in reality is actually named after nothing to do with the Lower Mainland either.
Like, it's because names grow to represent more than the original person that they are named after, and people grow emotionally attached to the thing itself, and the name is a part of it. Like, it's entirely understandable, though I think we can probably be adult about some things sometimes.
So that's Robert Burnaby. But you, Kelvin Gawley, where can people find you, follow you, read your work?
The best place to go is either pick up a copy of the Burnaby Now.
How much does that cost?
Oh, it's free. You can go to theburnabynow.com. Or you can also follow me on Twitter at KelvinGawley.
All right. Thank you for joining us today.
Cheers.
For the Canby Report edition, April 6th, 2019, I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Good night.